Make sure and subscribe to the YouTube channel so you can see video along with the audio for this podcast episode. There's also shorts coming out daily there that I think will add value. You can find a link to the show in the description if you're watching on your phone, or simply jump over to YouTube and search The Daily Real Estate Investor. Hit subscribe, and I hope it helps you on your real estate investing journey. Now let's dive in. Welcome back to another episode of the Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast. This is a show about achieving financial freedom through real estate investing. And today's guest is going to share his story on how he has done just that. I'm really excited to have Daniel Kong on the podcast with us. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me. It's love you guys' stuff. Excited to be on the show.
I've been looking at your stuff for a while, but I was just going back over it just now. I definitely want to talk about how you basically, within 3 years of starting real estate investing, you left your job and are basically financially free.
It was a little bit of luck involved in there, just because it was like unlucky and lucky too, right? Like a bunch of it happened during like the COVID like downturn time, is like there was some luck involved there as well too. But I mean, yeah, it was a little bit, I would have gotten there eventually. It probably would have taken me like 5 years.
With that being said, tell us a little bit about yourself and your story, so that way everybody can get to know you.
Yeah, so in 2018, I was working as a software developer, like zero real estate experience. I mean, like not the most like financially responsible. I was always told like don't have debt, so I had no debt, but then like no savings or anything like that. So I just like was renting a basement, kind of like living my life. Not the most frugal person, to be honest with you. But then I read this book called Rich Dad Poor Dad, which blew my mind. This whole idea of like passive income in my whole life, I've only known like 9 to 5. So I went to school, I got good grades, and I was happy. There was nothing wrong with that. But then when I read this book, Rich Dad Poor Dad, it opened my eyes to this idea of passive income and financial freedom. So, like, I never even knew that was a thing like back in the day. Because I never met anybody who was like financially free. And so it started this journey of just like, okay, I just started super hungry for this. Started like reading a ton of books, podcasts, and just like consuming as much as I could on financial freedom, and then also like risk investing. Originally, after reading the book, I was going to try going to stocks, because I was like, hey, I feel like I could reach financial freedom through passive income from stocks. But after all my research and kind of going down that rabbit hole, I came to the conclusion that that was not a viable path for me. Kind of dove all into real estate investing. The Huge Bigger Pockets family talk about like the burr strategy, which is basically a way to get cash flow rentals when you don't have money. I screamed, there's a creative way I was able to like access some money when I first started. We can talk about that later if you want to, but to got access to some funds, started doing burning out of state because I live in Hawaii, and it's not a great cash flow state in Hawaii. It's that first year, did 6 burrs in Indianapolis, and then it's like, hey, let's try to do some fix and flipping in Hawaii, because Hawaii is a great fix and flip state. And so like, let's do fix and flipping in Hawaii to build my burr machine in Indy faster until I reach that financial freedom number. But I got very lucky in Hawaii and found a bunch of burrs in Hawaii that kind of supercharged my cash flow. And so like in 2.5 years, I housed like just under 10 grand net cash flow, and like from my rental properties, which was more than I was making at my W-2 at the time. And so at that point, it was like, okay, I feel like the time I'm spending over here in this real estate space is like 10x what I'm getting in return than for my W-2. And so like we did it like 2.5 years. But then like I was like nearly married, and my wife was just not like, she was not happy with me saying I wanted to quit my job. So like, it was like just a little bit of just kind of like negotiation with her. And so after another 6 months, I finally would make that transition from like W-2 to now financial free, but now also just trying to build wealth and grow the ghosting a little bit more.
Dude, that's amazing. I love that. Although you're in Hawaii, which is a very expensive, relatively speaking, a very expensive market, that you were still able to figure out how to get some burr properties done. I love to talk about that. But you hit on a strategy that I really love, which is flipping properties to fund the long-term investment side. So you were flipping properties to fund the burr strategy. So in theory, for a market like Hawaii, where the properties are more expensive, but they're, it's like the California flips you see on TV, right? You buy for 500 grand and put 100K into it for the fix up, and then you sell it for $1 million. You've made, net of all the expenses, like 400 grand after all agent fees and all that. I mean, that's a flip that's like life changing money, because then you take that 400K and you do the out of state burr properties in Indianapolis. That 400K goes a long way, right? So I love what you've done here. So how did you make the jump from software engineer with no real estate? I know you said you like bigger pockets. Software engineer with no real estate to flipping properties in Hawaii, then buying Burr properties in Hawaii, and then investing out of state. Like, what was the thought process that went into that? And I ask because there's a lot of people that are listening to this that don't own any properties. They want to get going. They want to flip. They want to do Burr deals, and they just don't know how to get started.
So actually, I actually started out of state first because the properties, like you said, you're trying to purchase for $500, $800,000 for a purchase price. In my mind, that's impossible because I don't have any money to start with. But then I feel like in a cheaper price point, like Indianapolis, like the houses we can buy for like $50,000 to $80,000, like that's something that where I feel like I can kind of round up some money where I can play with. And so like in the very beginning, it was like I had zero real estate experience, but I was like super hungry. So like I literally was reading like 3 or 4 books a week, just consuming like 9 to 5 working and then like 5 to 12 reading and this podcast. And so like I actually like wrote like a little small script that was like for my software thing, just trying to find the right market. Like so I basically like scraped the web for like all turnkey properties and like a bunch of different like sites and web markets, put it to a data spreadsheet and say, on average, where is the highest cash flow on these turnkey properties? And the reason why I did that was because on the Burr strategy, on the refinance, you want to refinance into a cash flowing rental. So if the rental properties in that area on average cash flow higher, it's a lot easier process for you to find a property that's going to cash flow positive on the back. Just trying to make sure that like the market that I was in was going to cash flow positive on when I was doing the refinance. And so Indianapolis, it was like Memphis, there's a few different kind of like cities that kind of like met that metric. And then like with some more digging and research, it just so happened like Indianapolis was the one that I chose. Started out of state, just like I read David Green's How to Invest Out of State Real Estate Investing. And I just followed whatever the book said, like just basically whatever he said to do, call the agents, call the wholesalers, call the property managers, call the project managers. I just did exactly like what the book said. And then I started like the first bird deals, like out of state.
That's cool stuff. I know, honestly, I've never heard that somebody, you cash flow a lot. And then when you refi, your cash flow obviously reduces, but you got a turnkey property, which for those that don't know, turnkey is basically you get the property with a tenant already in it. So let's say if you're cash.
Go ahead. I didn't buy any turnkey properties. What I did was I like scraped the web for the turnkey properties that were being sold to find on exit which ones would be like which would be cash flow positive. So like it's all of mine were Burrs. I have never bought like a turnkey. It's odd because you always if you don't have money, you can't place, you can't buy turnkeys because you have to leave your cash aside there,
right?
Like it was a turnkey, it was just to see if the market supported like cash flow on the back end on the refinance.
That's interesting. When you first got started, you mentioned that you got access to some cash. How were you able to get that cash and what avenues did you use there?
So what I did was like someone got me into the strategy called a personal line of credit. I hope you guys are familiar with that. Basically, it's like you can go take a personal loan or personal line of credit, like your local bank with like no, like it's not secured against anything. So it's an unsecured loan. So you just go to your bank and say, hey, I've got an income and I've got a credit, a decent credit score. Can I take out a small loan or a personal line of credit? And so I went to like 5 banks on one day, like in my market and say, apply for like use 15, 20, 25, 30, whatever they'll give me as far as just like a personal line of credit. And then because I didn't have any other like debts at the time, like when I applied, I had like 0 debts, but then like and a decent income rate. So like one bank gave me like 15, one bank gave me like 20, one bank gave me 25. So I got like a bunch of like personal lines of credit from 5 different banks, like all like on the same day. And then like total, I got about like a little over $100,000 in just access to money. And so the way that a line of credit works is, you're only paying interest on it when you have it borrowed. You can do this with a personal loan or personal line of credit, but basically, if you don't have any like assets, this is a way that you can actually access funds like from just by having a job and a credit score. So got a little over 100 grand in like access line of credit, and then I also took a loan against my 401k. So like if you have 401k, you can take a loan either 50% or 50 grand, whichever is less. And then like there's no penalty for like the loan shit. You just have to pay it back like within 5 years. And so I had basically like about 160 and just like line access to money. And I was like, hey, this is enough for me to play in the Indianapolis market. And so went to bought a deal for a wholesaler for 70 grand, put in a $30,000 rehab, it appraised for 140. I refinanced out my $100,000 that I used to do it, paid back my line of credit and everything. And then it rented for $1,000 and my mortgage was like 750.
Yeah. And just a word of caution for those that don't know, you know, when you have a line of credit, Obviously, if you max it out, you're going to have to pay interest on that. So be sure that you are able to sustain that payment for the period that the money is going to be out of there. And similarly to the 401k, because I did it myself, Daniel, when I first got started with the 401k, they're going to, it's basically a loan and you have to pay that back within the 5 years.
Yeah,
so, of course, you'll have a fixed monthly amount that they'll take out of your paycheck while you do that. But that is a great way to get started. That's how I got started. I ended up getting a loan. I think it was a $12,000. My property was paying that loan off. So that's a great strategy for those that want to get started.
The other cool thing about the 401k loan is that you're borrowing it from yourself. And so you're paying yourself interest. Okay, so you figured out how to get the 100K. I love that. I have in the past, I would not recommend people do this necessarily unless they're really responsible with it. But I have taken out a zero interest credit card, drawn all that cash, used that money for deals, paid that off for us too.
Yeah. As long as you're willing to pay it off in that time period.
Yeah.
There's, I'm careful with that advice because there are people out there who struggle with being in too much debt. And I'm like you, Daniel, I always got rid of as much debt as possible. I always stayed debt free, except for things that were going up in value. So I didn't have any debt on my cars. I didn't have any debt on, I had paid all educational debts off. When I got married, we paid my wife's car off. We were living debt-free except for my house, right? And then when investment properties came along, I'm like, okay, zero interest for 12 months. I can buy this property, do the BRRRR strategy, refinance, pay the zero interest off, have a cash flowing asset. And that's how, I mean, that's just velocity of money 101. You take money at a low interest rate or zero interest at the time, and you apply it to something that's making you a much higher return, make money off the delta in the middle, and then pay the debt off, right? And I love that you were able to figure that out on the personal line of credit side. So on the personal line of credit side, were you doing this at commercial banks? I'm guessing this is like a commercial line of credit for you.
No, a personal line of credit. That's why it has to be a personal, because I didn't have a business at the time.
Personal line of credit, but it's not showing up. I guess when you were going to apply for these loans to buy these properties or refinancing the BRRRR deals, were all those lines of credit showing up on your credit report?
Yeah, they are showing up on your credits.
Okay. Your W-2 income was so good that it didn't matter. So,
well, I mean, like the properties were the monthly payment for the, I didn't have a house right at the time. So I was renting.
Right.
I mean, rent was like, not as cheap. It was only like $1,000 a month where we were super cheap. Like I had like the debt on my lines of credit, but they like the, because the loans are so cheap in the house and because it was actually was like rented at the time. So like rent, I mean, basically it's like almost like a net positive when you, it's not completely a net positive, but also wash as far as like the safety of the rental property. So like it's a, as far as like qualifying for it with, under my personal like income, like my income more than covered like the small debt payments to like the lines of credit and then also like the new mortgages you're taking out with like the cash flow positive rental property, right? So.
Yeah, and I will say one hack to credit cards and any either lines of credits or loans. If you apply today, let's say for a personal credit card, you got 14 days for people to run your credit score with only having one inquiry.
Yeah.
So that's probably, Daniel, that's one of the strategies that you use. Within those that time frame, you were able to get your credit ran by these banks, and it won't show up because it's within 14 days you can run credit within the same family, I guess I want to call it. So, Daniel, when you first, since you've reached financial freedom, and where were you from the moment that you quit your W-2? Did you have a car loan? Did you have student loans? Where were you? And what were your thoughts when you went to the transition of like, all right, software engineering world, I'm out?
Well, I mean, like I said, we got very lucky as far as like the last like 2.5 years of just like investing. We made like, we got like a bunch of BRRRR properties in Indianapolis and a bunch of BRRRR properties here in Hawaii. And we also did a few picks of this where I made us a bunch of cash, which like added to like my, what I was making my W-2, right? So like financially, we were pulling like just under 10 grand a month from like the net passive income from our rentals. And I had about like a year and a half worth of salary saved up from those other flips.
Mm.
So basically like at that point in time, if I just lived on the beach for the rest of my life, I would have been fine because I was making exactly what I was making or more than I was making on my W-2. So like, from a financial standpoint, it was very safe. When I started the journey, I didn't have any debt. Like I bought my cars. I'm like, I was super anti-debt. I was like, buy all my cars in cash. I paid off my student loans, and I just like, no, yeah, I just like super anti-debt from the start. So I had no debt to begin with. But now it's funny because now I'm like, I borrow money at 12% like all day. Like I've got millions of dollars out at 12%, but I want more money to do, like, because the velocity that we can move in is so much faster now that, like, at least as an experienced investor. But at the time, it was like no debt, just the rental properties that were cash flow positive. So it was kind of good debt. And then like a year and a half worth of salary that saved up. So like my wife felt safe. I was like, hey, it came down to like the flipping that I was doing in Hawaii. Like that, when you look at like the net worth increase and like the wealth I'm building, it was like 10 times what I was making on my W-2. So it was almost like my W-2 was holding me back from like what I could do. So when I was doing here part-time, it was like almost 10x what I was doing on my W-2. It was like, W-2 just even didn't make sense for me to like to be there. It was almost like a huge waste of my time at that point. So that was kind of like the thought process where like I was able to kind of like leave the W-2 and kind of go full-time into like the real estate investing world.
I love that. And it's such an interesting point you're making. How many of us have quote-unquote safe jobs that are keeping us in a line of work that doesn't really make a lot of sense for us considering our alternative, right? So you figured out how to flip houses, how to do these bird deals. It was making you a good bit of money. And you've got this W-2 job that you've, you know, been educated for. You've worked here for a while. You've got a great, you're making great money at it, right? And it's
always not great, but I mean, I'll survive. But.
Right, right. You're making money at it. You're not, if you weren't making money, you wouldn't be doing it, right? So, But it's the safe thing, right? Supposedly, it's the safer thing to have these W-2 jobs. And then, so what happens? It's like it's the carrot, right? That you're always, oh, I got the safety and this money, and it's like taking the jump requires, you know, a bit of faith, and it's kind of like jumping out of an airplane, building a parachute on the way down. Until you do it and you take that leap, you're always just kind of in this stage of like thinking it'll work, not sure, don't know if you want to do it. And when I made that leap, you know, I left the W-2 world with I had worked in the W-2 world for a while. My income had gone up to where it was difficult to leave. But man, I was like, I felt like dead inside working there. You know, I really did not like the work. And I knew I was going to take a pay cut temporarily once I left, but I was going to be working for myself. And I figured out that the number one thing for me is flexibility. And I figured out that if I had flexibility, I could take that free time and get creative on ways to make more money, whether it's flips, starting another business, starting a business with the licenses I already had. So the second I made the jump and started working for myself, my quality of life went up. I started enjoying my work a lot more. I was a lot less stressed and my income went through the roof. So I know this would be the case for a lot of the listeners out there. I would just encourage you, you know, don't do anything rash and do anything irresponsible. But once you get to the point where you have an inclination that this over here might be a better option for you, seriously explore it, because you can do a lot better financially when you've got some time to really work on things that can make you a lot of money. You have a lot of potential over there. So don't ignore that just because you have something that's quote unquote safer over here.
I think for me personally, I'm like super risk averse. I know it sounds crazy because you're a real estate investor and there's like risk involved, but I'm like a super risk adverse person where I don't like betting unless I know I can win. And so like for me, I rather like, so I think I probably like stunted some of my growth by like not leaving like sooner, but then like, I was like, I want to make sure that like, that I'm like super secure financially before I make the leap. So that's why like, I was I made sure that like, I was very sick. When I made the leap, it wasn't like there was no like leap of faith, like anything. I was already set at that point in time. But I was grinding like super hard, like that, because you said, like the, when you're working at 9 to 5, like I was probably like working like 40 hours here and then like 80 hours, like in the investing side. And so like, I didn't want, or plus with my wife would not let me leave until we're the kind. So that was that as well too. But basically, like, I think like until you're like, so it's kind of two ways. One is like, once you believe and you see the proof of concept and you know you can do it, then just move right away and you'll supercharge your growth faster. But if you want to take it a slower way and just be like, I'm just going to keep hustling super hard over here while I'm working my W-2, then like it'll allow you to like have the safety when you change. And then also, like you can qualify for a few more like loans. And so like a bunch of the properties that we refinance, we actually use like our income to help us qualify for like the houses. So like got a little bit lower interest rate. I mean, you can still do it as a DSCR loan, these other things too. But just there's another way where like you can just side hustle super hard until like this, it doesn't make sense to leave that year.
I also had the side hustle thing going on. You know, I had a job teaching on the college. I was teaching finance on the college level for several years. The entire time I was working on Burr properties on the side, getting that built up, flipping houses. And then when I made the jump to leave, I had taken another job, and it was a large real estate services, Fortune 500 real estate services firm. I was working in one of their real estate valuation department. It was sitting in a cubicle. It was just miserable. I had a high income, but my wife was still working, right? So I had some security blanket there, and I knew real estate. And I was like, okay, this is the time for me. We jump out. We've got savings. We can still make ends meet, but I want to pursue this other thing. So I didn't just throw caution to the wind. I'm not super risk averse, but I'm definitely not. I've met people that are less risk averse than me. You know what I mean? So I understand where you're coming from, Daniel. Let's talk about some of these flips in Hawaii. I think that'd be cool. So there's people that live in markets that are expensive and are looking to, you know, you hear all the time, I can't find a Burr property in this market that I live in. It's too expensive.
So, I mean, like a Burr deal is basically like a flip that has like a little bit more equity than an Irish flip. And also there's a way to rent it out for more than like Irish in a vacant in Hawaii or a high price market. So like it'll be like a duplex or a triplex or like an Airbnb or something along those lines. And then, so the way we're sourcing them now is like, we have a website where people can come in and say like, hey, I want a summer house, like a summer house SaaS website. We have like, we go on the MLS where we put like, we blast offers like all day. And then just, we also have like outreaching to agents where we're trying to like say, hey, if you've got like a house that needs a lot of work or a hoarder house or like people who are like, who want a fast close with no like contingencies, call us, we're your guys. So like kind of like just like a combination of like our website, some MLS like spamming, and then just trying to like talk to agents who might have opportunities that will make sense for us.
Yeah, that's good. I know one of the things, so you have markets like, for example, Indianapolis, where it's super cheap. Then you have Hawaii, which is obviously a whole different world. However, real estate is very, it's very similar in places. So like in Hawaii, yes, properties are more expensive. Your mortgage is going to be higher, but your rent is also going to be higher. So everything,
rent is not higher in Hawaii, like relative to the price. That's why most properties like negative cash flows. That's the one you're going to rent to like in the higher price market. So like a $1 million house is only going to rent for like $3,000 or $2,000, which is like, it's not like the value is on the land. So like, if you look at like a $5 million house, like $850,000 of that is a land, and $150,000 is a house. So you got a small house. It's hard to find cash flow unless you get like creative where you have like a multiple units or like there's an Airbnb.
So do you see a lot of people over in Hawaii playing the appreciation game, just waiting until the property goes up in value?
Everybody's playing the appreciation game. Even us, too, some of our properties are cash flow evens just because like we believe in the appreciation game. We think like, so I think in the long run, the appreciation game can blow out like any cash flow that you're getting, but it's just like you got to be able to have like the reserves and the stomach to be have like negative cash flow.
Yeah, and I have a follow-up question in a little bit, but I wanted to say, since we're on this point, I know when back in 2021, second quarter, I was completely dry, no deals at all. And it was because my buy box, my criteria was up to $100,000 for the home the maximum price that I would pay for a house. Yeah. And I remember I was like, nothing was coming through. And then I sat down and I looked at a far view and I was like, what's going on here? And it was that I needed to obviously increase my max purchase price, and properties were still making deal. So if you're not finding a property, analyze your market again, because stuff changes over time. We saw that in 2021, how prices and rent went up like crazy. Yeah. But talking about Hawaii, Daniel, and speaking about short-term rental, do you see a lot of banning, and do you see a lot of the government getting very strict when it comes to Airbnb over there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just like more and more lockdown. I think a big thing is like it's the hotels don't like us because like it's a huge like bloated business, and they have a lot of lobbying power, I think. So like, and the grassroots people are obviously complaining like it's a noise or a nuisance to the neighborhood, which it is in some small cases. But the big thing is like the movers and shakers are like, we don't like how this is hurting our hundreds of millions of dollars that we pull in. So like they're going to eventually shut down if it's against their interests. So like, we've seen this across Hawaii where like just single family houses in general, like it's almost impossible to get like a legally zoned Airbnb like anywhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's something I'll tell everybody. Always have multiple exit strategies when you have a property. Like if a property makes sense, you know, short-term rental, just make sure that it also makes sense either as a long-term rental or as a buy and hold for a while and then sell it. Make sure you have your backup plans because the government has a lot of power. Let's say you're in a market where they cancel it just like they did in Dallas. If that was to happen to you, you're in bad shape right there. So just always make sure you have multiple exit strategies. I always recommend three because if plan A doesn't work, plan B as well, you also got a third plan. So always have your backup strategies.
And I think it also matters too is like the stage you're in your career. So when you're first starting out, you want to be more conservative, have multiple exit strategies, and you want to consider like you don't want your first deal to be your last, like, you know, but once you build up some like wealth, you have some extra cash flow they can stomach it, or you have like more bigger cash reserves, now you can go and take on more risky properties. So like that's what we're kind of seeing is like we're willing to take the risk that Airbnb is gonna shut down because it's worth it for us versus like the risk. And if it, like say the worst case happens, we can stomach the loss now that we have built up so well. And so it's kind of like, it matters where you are in your journey. But when you first started out, I say like, be super, super safe and make sure that it'll cash flow as a long-term rental.
Yeah, I always try to think, what is my worst case scenario here? And am I okay with that? And I never want to take a bet that if I lose that bet, it's going to put me out of the game completely. The most successful investors I know, they're happy to take base hits and then they occasionally hit home runs and they start scaling up the level of risk they're taking and the size of the deals they're doing. But generally, they're not chasing, you know, very thin margin deals. They're going after deals that are at a minimum a base hit, at a, you know, and hopefully better, right? And then as over time, as you get reps investing in the asset class you're investing in, whether it be single family, you know, vacation rental, moving on up to, you know, Tony's developing a mobile home park currently, you know, multifamily, self-storage. The more reps you get, the more able you are to recognize when the pitch is coming down, you know, that looks like something you could hit a home run on. And then when you see those pitches, those are the ones you're like, okay, my downside is I may lose 10% on this. My upside is, you know, exponentially higher than the downside. And those asymmetrical risk deals are the ones you want to go after, right? So, and I think the same way about stocks or whatever else you invest in, you always want to chase an asymmetrical risk to the upside with a limited downside. You don't want to go in something that has a massive downside and very little upside, right? That's the kind of thing that'll really put you out of the game.
Super, super good point. I think like the whole idea of asymmetrical risk, I think is a genius like kind of like concept. I think a lot of people are not aware of this, but like the real estate allows you to have like these super asymmetrical bets where like you buy with a ton of equity or these opportunities where the risk is very low, but the upside is very high. I think like when you're looking at stocks, it's usually like high risk, high reward or low risk reward. It's very hard to like buy a stock on sale because you can't buy like $100 stock for like $50, right? But you can buy a $100,000 house for $50,000. So like just built in, like the work you can put into real estate allows you to have like these huge asymmetrical bets, which I think is like a the way to kind of supercharge like your wealth creation.
I totally agree. And one way to put you in the driver's seat on an asymmetrical risk type investment is using the BRRRR strategy, because if you can buy that as a distressed property, get that fixed up, on the refinance, get all of your capital back, then you're playing with house money and that de-risk your situation. So yes, you still have the debt on the property, but if you have 25% equity or more, and you got to know your market and know, okay, if the crap hits the fan in this market, how much will the values go down here? You have to really experience a 25% decrease in the market values to really ever start losing money on that deal, as long as it's cash flow positive. So that creates an asymmetrical risk to the upside. You have a lot more upside than you do downside. That's why the BRRRR strategy is such a great way to get started. And even if you're doing deals and you're leaving a little bit of money in, I always like to think of it like you do a BRRRR deal, you leave $5,000 in, but you created $80,000 of equity and that thing's making you $10,000 a year profit. Well, your cash on cash return on that $5,000 just on the profit is 200%, right? So I'll take that all day long. Like Warren Buffett's gotten 21% his entire career. He was the wealthiest man in the world for a while. So if you can be 21% a year with your money, just keep doing deals. Keep doing deals and it will pile up for you.
Yeah, I was gonna say, so speaking of risk, let's take a 100-foot view real quick, and I'm gonna ask a question to both of you guys. How do you guys, when you face a risky situation in general, not maybe not necessarily real estate, but in general, when you face a risky situation, how do you guys help yourself by taking, obviously taking the opportunity? What actions do you take, or what data do you look for when you're about to take the jump or not take the jump? One of you guys can go first.
I think for me, like, I just look at all the things that could go wrong and how can I mitigate that, right? So like, you're going to buy a property out of state. Like, so like, are you trying to figure out all the things that could go wrong? Like, what if my house burns down? What if I can't find tenants? What if I'm in a bad neighborhood? What if I can't find a property manager? And just try to list every single thing that could go wrong and like the risk associated with it. I think as an investor now, like, I'm looking at things like from a dollar value. Like, okay, this could cost me this much, cost me this much. Getting sued cost me this much. And then like, then work backwards to say like, what is like the way to kind of prevent this or stop this or like lower that risk? And then how much time, energy, and money is that going to cost me? And you kind of add them all together. And like, there's a formula where like, okay, if I just make enough phone calls, I can find the credibility of the property manager. Or like, I can, if I'm in a big city, I can always find a new one because there's a lot available, right? Or like, let's say like if my house is burned down, I'll just buy like insurance on this house. And so there's a lot of ways that where you can like see like the risks that you're facing and either mitigate it or like get it down to like very small.
How about you, Josiah?
I always think the greatest risk when I'm analyzing a deal is what you don't know, right? Like if you know all the different variables in your equation, you can mitigate the risk. Typically where investors will get themselves in trouble is they won't know one piece of it and they'll make an assumption that, and that assumption is incorrect. So let's say, well, I don't know what vacancy rate is here, but I'm going to say 5%. Well, if vacancy rate's 15% in that market, your cash flow just got nailed, right? Or I'm going to assume insurance is $1,000 a year. You don't check on the insurance rates, you get in your deal, your insurance comes in $4,000 a year, your cash flows just took a major hit. So I always try to ask myself, what is it that I don't know in my analysis that I don't feel comfortable with in my analysis, and really dig into that. So I start there. And if I feel like I could do BRRRR properties in my sleep now because I've done so many of them. But when I started off, the unknowns were, you know, is my contractor going to be able to do this project at what they're quoting me? And very often they would go over budget. So I started learning I had to actually estimate higher than what the contractor was telling me to compensate for them going over budget. You know, another thing is, you know, you think you can do this BRRRR deal in 3 months, but if it takes 6 months, there's holding costs. Your holding costs have doubled. So are you estimating a proper hold time on your BRRRR deal? You know, there's so many different ways this can go sideways on you. So I think the number one thing you've got to do is think about, what do I know the least about in this analysis, and really focus on getting the proper amount of education on that to really mitigate the risk. What about you, Tony? Yeah.
No, I think you guys hit the really good points. I think it was an author called George Anton, and in one of his books he wrote, he basically had a chart. And in one column he had risk. He has, if that was to happen, what do I need to do to make sure I'm okay? And I just put an example of something that happened to me. The risk was, if I was to die, would my wife be okay? And if I die, it's going to be, I mean, there's so much moving pieces when it comes to real estate right now with my portfolio and everything, that my wife will have no idea on what to do. She'll obviously have the income, but she won't know who to pay, what goes where. So one of the things that I did because of that was, I got a term life insurance policy, which I hate term life, but for the case for protection of my wife, I made sure I got a term life insurance policy just so she's covered in the case something was to happen to me. Now, obviously, I already instructed her on how to manage that money once that happens, if that was to ever happen. But this is the thing, you know, make actions that will just make sure you're covered. And then, like you guys said, you know, add some percentages for stuff that may happen in the market. That's what banks do. The reason why we pay either 20%, you know, or 25% down payment is because banks know the risk if you were to not pay them. So the 25% is their cushion in case you were to be foreclosed on. So yeah, just look up your education and just take actions to make sure you're covered if something was to happen. So Daniel, how does your company structure right now? What's going on there?
So after I left my job, I kind of went like gung ho onto just like flipping and investing. And so it's flipping has been kind of lucrative for us in Hawaii. And then trying to offset some of those gains, like we started looking into commercial properties in the mainland, because in the mainland you can get like better depreciation, better cash flow across the board. And so we're actually starting to transition more into commercial properties now because the deals are bigger, but the returns are also bigger as well too. And we see like a lot of like opportunity, I think, in that space right now. And so we're like, we built a small team to like, so after like I quit, I was like, flipping houses is like a lot of work, man. So like that, if I can like have like a team or somebody to help me along with the journey, it'll just make it like I can do more and be more enjoyable, et cetera. So we have like a small team now. We have like a bunch of full-time people, some part-time people who are like, we're flipping houses in Hawaii. And then where the focus now is like buying either small businesses or doing commercial burrs in Kansas City. So that's kind of like what our current strategy is looking at right now.
Yeah, that's something beautiful. I mean, now you've done single family for a while, and now you're going to commercial. That's one beauty of the compound effect. When you start in real estate, it's great to start in single family because that's really the easiest way to get started. But once you get to a certain point, I recommend everybody starts looking, you know, start looking up, start looking for, well, what's the next level for you to take?
Trading up. That's the rich dad, poor dad strategy, right? Trade up.
Yep.
I mean, when I started, I was doing like the $50,000 houses in Indianapolis, right? Then like that kind of graduated to like the $1 million houses, a single family still in Hawaii. Now we're looking at like the multi-million-dollar or bigger deals in Kansas City and commercial. And just, it's just like, once like you prove it here, like then you can like take it to the next step, take the same skill set, expand on a little bit and try and grow. You always try to like grow as an investor, as an entrepreneur, just to get to that next level, I think. And so it's just like a natural progression as you're learning and as you're growing, as you're investing.
Mm-hmm.
So your current strategy is flipping and then taking that capital and buying commercial. Do you see yourself continuing to flip indefinitely to generate investment capital, or are you focusing on raising money for the commercial deals, or what's your strategy there?
Actually, like one of the things about our business is that like I think a lot of it actually was from social media, where we had like a big kind of blow up in social media the last like year and a half, and we have like a large amount of people who wanted like partner or invest with in our deals in Hawaii. And so we raised a ton of money in Hawaii for like our deals, but then we had actually more like people who wanted to lend the deals that are available. And so like we actually like parlayed that into some of the commercial deals, and so we're actually using partially our own money, but also money from our investors to kind of buy these bigger deals on the mainland. So like that's huge. And we're also GP like 102 unit in Houston. Basically, like we're trying to like leverage these things where like we're building a skill set and like a platform over here that's actually synergistic and translate over like to the next opportunity. And so a lot of it is going to be like raising money to buy these bigger deals and then like do the same thing to brochure.
So do you see yourself continuing the flipping, or is that you're going to keep doing it as long as it's making money, or what's your plan there?
Yeah, I mean, like now that we have a team, like I'm not super involved in the business. So like as long as the team's running it, like we'll go on indefinitely and say.
So selfishly, I'm curious about how you set your team up, because I've been doing flips and I'm looking at building a team to do flips for me. So tell me more about that.
So, I mean, I'll go in order. Like when I first started, it was virtual assistants, just kind of help with admin tasks, et cetera. Then we hired an in-person admin, which is like super huge, just taking all like out of paperwork on your plate. It was like an admin / transaction coordinator stuff, right? So then now I'm just raising money, finding deals and managing projects. The next hire was a project manager to help like manage all the projects. So now I'm just finding deals and finding money. And then after that, we hired a lender relations person. So like a accounting / lender relations. So we got a girl who's doing like, so these are all in person right now. And there's like, we have a virtual bookkeeper who helps our like lender relations / accountant in person to kind of support her and do like more of the busy work. And then we just kind of onboarded like an acquisition manager and like acquisitions kind of like part-timer to kind of help on the acquisition side. So like we got like two guys in acquisitions, one person doing project management, one person doing accounting and lender relations, another doing general admin and transaction coordination, and some virtual assistant for like some social media stuff, a virtual assistant for like some bookkeeping, and we got another like part-timer doing like to our podcast, which we're kind of just launched to.
I love that. By the way, I just subscribed to that. I'm excited about listening to it. I love the system that you're building here. That is everything as you grow your business. Michael Gerber, The E-Myth Revisited, one of my favorite business books. Check that one out if you've not read that one.
I love that book.
He says you got to be working on your business and not in your business, right? And that's what you're doing perfectly here. You're building a system that's allowing you to scale. You're getting to work on raising money, buying commercial deals, and markets are going to really move the needle for you. You've empowered your team by hiring all these different these different roles to continuing this flipping thing for you that's generating a lot of investment capital, that really blows the whole thing up. And the second that I did that in my own business, I really started growing a lot as well. And that's the special sauce in all this, is you got to be able to build your system. And if you're good at building systems, you can be an extraordinary real estate investor.
I was going to say, to add to that, in the same book, in the E-Myth Revisited, he created a plan, like a 1 year, 3 year, and 10 year plan. And it was like, imagine a family tree diagram. And at the top is you as the CEO and president. Under you are all the vice presidents. And under that, you know, is the other employees. And when you first start your company, you're doing everybody's job. But as you continue on, you start eliminating jobs little by little. And I assume, Daniel, that's what you did. You know, you saw the need for an accountant. And now you can take Daniel's name off of that cube. And now you have Jane Doe in that position. And now you have more time to focus on the other task or do whatever you want with your time. So that's one of the things I loved about that book.
I love that book. And I think one thing that I've learned, or I've come to realize, that the skill set of building a team and leading a team is 100% different than actually investing yourself. The skill set, like as an investor, is like you're finding deals, you're trying to find money, you're managing projects. It's different than like trying to hire people, keep them motivated, inspired, and like as opposed to like when you just be like a 100% investor. So
since both of you are already financially free, again, this is a question for both of you guys, because I look up to both of you guys already. So, so when you guys were trying to reach financial freedom, what were the milestones or the steps that you said, okay, I need to get to this before I can finally quit my job, or I need to get rid of this debt before I finally, stop flipping, or whatever the case might be? What were those milestones that you guys reach or were looking at when you guys trying to reach financial freedom?
I mean, just I just want to replace my income. I think there was like not a whole lot of like thought process. It was like, I have this goal. I want to like make as much as I'm making or more than I'm making my W-2 passively. How can I get there? And I think through the process, the person was like, hey, get your first deal, right? And like, there's a lot of small steps that led to that. But like the goal was always just like, hey, I just want to replace my income at like $10,000 a month, like the $8,000 a month to replace me. But my goal is like $10,000. So like just like focus on that goal. And then just everything kind of like, so underneath that one bigger goal, I'd say.
My threshold for leaving my W-2 was, when do I feel like I'm good enough at the real estate thing to make the jump? And so while I was doing the college professor thing, I was doing flips and bird deals on the side. So I still had that income, that safety net, and my wife was still working. The second that I had, the first three deals, this is funny. One of my buddies from out of state contacted me, had a good year in sales. He had a chunk of money. He's like, I don't know what to do with this. Thinking about buying some real estate, but I don't know what I'm doing. You seem like you know what you're doing better than me. And I was like, well, I'll try to get us some bird deals. You can fund them and I'll go do everything on the deal. I'll find the deal, handle the rehab, handle the refinance, everything. And then I'll try to get you your money back. Well, the first three deals we did, we got all of our money back and then some. And he was like, this is ridiculous. He's like, I haven't even seen these properties. Haven't been inside these properties. I don't know anything about them. He's like, I'm just getting ownership and properties out of state by just signing some documents that are sent to me every now and then. And we gained like $220,000 in equity or something crazy. And that's when I knew, I was like, okay, Dan, you were talking about like, it doesn't make sense for me to keep doing this over here. And so that's when I made the jump. So it wasn't really necessarily about how much money I was making, although I wanted to replace my income, but it was more about, do I feel like the knowledge I have and my ability to make deals work is good enough that I'm not going to completely screw my family over by doing this? So that was it for me.
That's very, good points. Definitely, looking at all the aspects help. And then just keep in mind too, that as a W-2 employee, we're not taxed the same once you become a business owner or business itself. So that's something, that's a metric that I'm looking at. I know I don't have to be, I'm a mechanical engineer. I don't have to have my six-figure income. And then in real estate, it doesn't need to be a six-figure income in order for me to finally leave that W-2. So that's definitely one of the things I'm tracking into. We've been talking here in the podcast, the risk of you leaving your W-2, what are those things that are going to affect you? And those are the things that I'm keeping track of.
Yeah, the tax benefits of working for yourself, that's one of the best parts about it. So that was a huge benefit. Well, Daniel, man, this has been awesome. Thanks so much for sharing your story. Let me ask you one question before we go to wrap us up. What do you think is the one quality that you see as a common thread amongst those that are successful as real estate investors?
I think like it's honestly just like you probably hear this all the time, but just like taking action. I think like the guys who are like, I see like that you meet at a meetup and they're like, they go to a lot of meetups, but there's no like traction or action in their life. They're not like action takers, but the guys are like, as soon as they learn something like that day, they apply it and they apply it like with like gusto. That's where I see like the success. And I think like you also have to have an obsession with real estate investing. If you want to get there like at any speed, like you can get there like super slowly over like 20, 30 years and like you'll get there. But if you want to kind of get there faster, like you kind of have to just be obsessed and just take massive action like daily, I think. So that's a lot of times it's action that's either not fun or you're like, it's not the most thing that you want to do, but it's like the most necessary thing. So
I love that. Be obsessed, take massive action, and go after it with gusto. That is what will move the needle for you as a real estate investor. I totally agree, Daniel. Daniel, where can people find out more about you?
You can find me on Instagram at DanielKong808. That's probably my main spot.
Daniel, if you're ever in Alabama, look me up, man. We and Tony and I will take you out to lunch.
Will do, man. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us today. And guys, we appreciate you listening. Hit the like button. Share this with your friends. If you haven't left us a rating, leave us a rating on the podcast platforms you're listening to. And if you're not subscribed on YouTube, please subscribe. We love you guys, and we'll see you next time.